You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's episode is sponsored by Nadex. Imagine if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front. That way you could try day trading the markets without worrying about the risk. Well, luckily you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. It's that time of year again, when the air gets crisper and the days grow shorter, and we set aside our rational minds and allow ourselves to be frightened by ghouls, vampires, and werewolves. Whether going on a haunted hayride or trick-or-treating or shuddering and covering our eyes in a darkened theater, there's a perverse thrill in getting momentarily spooked by the things we know can't possibly exist. But what if it's more complicated than that? What if there are still things that can't just be explained away with smartphones and Wikipedia? What if there are still dark corners of the earth that inspire a primal dread? What if monsters really do exist, and the scariest monster of all is us? Well, then you're getting into the eerie territory of a podcast called Lore, which delves into the roots of our fears and exposes the darker side of history, exploring the creatures, people, and places of our wildest nightmares. The popular award-winning podcast that's garnered 100 million listens has recently spawned a TV anthology series for Amazon and a trilogy of books beginning with The World of Lore, Monstrous Creatures. And today, just to get you in the Halloween mood, I'm talking with the writer, host, and producer of Lore, Aaron Mankey. Aaron will talk about the real stories behind ghosts, vampires, and werewolves, and the horrific things we humans sometimes do to ourselves and to others to protect ourselves from threats we don't understand. He talks about the spiritualism craze of the turn of the century, the most sadistic witch hunters throughout the ages, and how all too often our scary folktales and beliefs say a lot about our attitudes toward women, outsiders, and anyone different. What's more, Aaron says there's a thin line between the superstitions of old and the paranoia and conspiracy theories of today. Plus, we talk about the Jersey Devil, the Beast of Bray Road, gremlins, fairies, and more with Lore's Aaron Mankey coming up in just a moment. Aaron Mankey is the creator and host of the popular Lore podcast, which as of this month also includes a Lore original television series for Amazon and a brand new book called The World of Lore, Monstrous Creatures. Aaron, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Aaron, I have to confess that I'm relatively new to lore. I only started listening to the podcast after I saw Amazon was doing this anthology series a couple of months ago, but I'm definitely hooked now. And I think one of the reasons I was such a latecomer is because so many had mischaracterized lore as a horror podcast, which I don't think really does it justice. You describe it as a podcast about dark history. What kind of subjects fit under the umbrella of dark history?
Yeah, I sort of chafe under that horror label. It's not intended to be frightening. It's more an interest in those historical events in the past, whether it's a person or an event, maybe a location. Those events in the past that just sort of defy the normal expectations we have for history, and they often are a little bit on the darker side, whether it's unusual frightening sightings or serial killers that, have given birth to certain stereotypes or archetypes of the horror genre. But yeah, I sort of avoid that horror label if I can.
Were you a creepy kid growing up? Where did your interest in scary stories and dark history originate?
As best as I can tell, I think it goes back to fifth grade for me. It was the year that I was sent home with one of those Scholastic Readers Club catalogs. You remember those, the yeah, color newsprint things? And I've got a lot of books out of those over the years, but it was in fifth grade, I think, I saw some sort of a book. It was a collection of weird and unusual tales. And I sadly don't remember the name of the author. I don't remember the name of the book, but there were stories in that book that just latched on. And I don't know, they sparked something inside of me. And since that moment, all I've wanted to do is read about and retell these old stories from our past that have this weird and unusual bent to them. And yeah, it stuck with me for, it's been 30 plus years now.
How much digging do you have to do when you're researching these stories? I'm assuming that sometimes you're dealing with old newspaper accounts or even stories that may have been passed down verbally. Perhaps they're not always digitally archived or Googleable, I'm assuming.
Well, what I've discovered is that every episode is just slightly different. It's almost like a built-in variety for my research process. So yeah, some episodes, if they're more of a local tale, something like Mothman, which is a more common and well-known legend today, but at the time it was a very local event. That's something where you really need to dig into local newspapers and testimony from people who saw things. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got more global phenomena like werewolves or vampires. And it seems to be a very widespread of stories that pop out. And so every episode I sit down to research, it's just a matter of trying to figure out what the best path is for that particular topic and then going as deep as I can.
I understand that you live on Boston's North Shore, not far from Salem, the heart of New England, H.P. Lovecraft territory, Stephen King as well. Did you purposely choose to settle in a place with a lot of dark history?
No, that'd have been a little bit too... I don't know if cliche is the right word, but it's where I ended up. And, very, very fortuitous living in Lovecraft County here, which isn't the county's real name. But, the area that I live, all of the cities are where Lovecraft grabbed his geography from and kind of relabeled it. And of course, with Salem nearby, with its witch history and the industry that exists today around it. It's pretty neat to live in this area. Plus, it's just, it's old New England, right? It's moody. It's full of character. It's got a lot of story.
Yeah, and so many of these stories take place in this sweet spot between colonial and mid-19th century America, when we seem to be sort of in limbo, having one foot in the old world with all of these old European superstitions and monsters, and another foot in the new world with its promise of enlightenment and industrialization, but at the same time, new unknowns and new fears of things like science run amok, big cities, and the machine age.
Well, I think scary stories work really well anywhere there are questions that don't have answers. And certainly, the time periods you're talking about, anywhere from the mid-1600s up through the late 1800s, it was a time where at various stages we really thought we had it all figured out, but there was always that gap. There was always, a hole in our knowledge, our collective knowledge. And, especially when you come to a place like New England, 300 or 400 years ago, where it was sort of the first melting pot of cultures on, the North American continent, where you had all of these different European peoples coming over and then interacting with Native Americans who had been here for, 10,000 years or more. And, the tales that spring up out of that are just amazing. And there's a lot of cultural variances.
And it's not a linear progression away from these old beliefs either. We seem to sort of repeat these cycles, turning away from superstition to science and then retreating back to the old ideas and primal fears over and over again. I think a good example of this is the spiritualism craze around the turn of the century. Here we are making all kinds of advances in science and medicine. It's the dawn of the American century, and hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions, choose to believe in ghosts and are desperate to connect to the other side. In fact, you even have celebrities like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Harry Houdini getting in on it. What led to this sudden explosion in spiritualism around that time? Why then?
Well, you know, there's like a lot of huge movements, and at its height, I think spiritualism had maybe 8 or 9 million people around the world who bought in and would say that they fit that club. I think like a lot of large movements like that, there are many sources, but one of the big drives for it had to be the Civil War and this idea where people were coming back from, you know, the biggest tragedy we had experienced as a country. It was almost as if every family in America had lost someone, right? And so everybody was dealing with this idea of loss and grief and pain. And it was very tempting to believe that there was a way to reach beyond that veil that separates life and death and communicate not just with the other world, but maybe potentially communicate with the people that we lost. And so, you know, this idea of the seance comes on the scene as a very popular way of, you know, doing that. And spiritualism for decades, just, it ran the show. I mean, it influenced popular culture and songs and stage acts. And it took people like Harry Houdini, who you mentioned, who, you know, he had a career just performing magic on stage and doing these amazing tricks. You know, he was the first David Copperfield, and it kind of knocks him off the rails, and it becomes an obsession of his to seek out these spiritualist people and debunk them, right?
Yeah, he dedicated the last years of his life to exposing phony mediums, and he would get furious when he caught fraudulent spiritualists trying to take advantage of people's grief. It just shows how much ghosts and ghost stories have dominated our culture here in America. But not only ghosts. I was interested to read in your book, Monstrous Creatures, how many of the beliefs about vampires weren't just left behind in the old country, but came over with immigrants and were even practiced here. Looking back over our history right here in the U.S., were you as surprised as I was at how many flare-ups of vampire hysteria we've had?
Yeah, you know, vampires across the last few hundred years they've almost been like bell bottoms. You know, they come back in some new weird form every now and then. And you know, the European, especially the Eastern European things, Romania, Hungary, those were very different stories than what we are used to. And some of the elements have kind of migrated over, but a lot of the American vampire stories are just very unique in this mix. We've been able to figure out through some research for the TV show and, you know, my work over the last couple of years that these New England vampire incidences that took place for about a century from the late 1700s to the late 1800s were rooted in some part in some German folklore as well. And, you know, it's just been interesting to see it all come together, but it's, you know, no matter where you go, there's always a story about the undead who come back to feed on the living. And I don't know why, but it's a global fear.
It is. And I think one of the most amazing stories in here is about a farmer who had a son who was dying of tuberculosis. So a vampire hunter talks him into digging up the corpse of his daughter. They then cut out her heart and liver, burn them, and then mix the ashes into some sort of potion that this farmer then feeds to his son, as if cannibalism was supposed to cure him. And of course, later he dies anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, for context, and that's essentially what I do, is I tell stories with context. You know, I mm-hmm. provide the historical details that back up or inform weird moments like that. You know, and you're talking about Mercy Brown, this young woman in 1890s Exeter, Rhode Island. And, you know, the common folklore at the time, and this was thanks to some Germans who came over. If you think back, the American Revolution was between the British and the English, but You know, we had allies and they had allies, and the British were hiring German mercenaries to come in and fight for them. And those German mercenaries brought their own doctors with them. And German physicians at the time in the late 1700s adhered to this idea from this German doctor named George Stahl that had to do with, you know, where the soul lived in the body. And he had some, you know, unique ideas about that. And obviously the heart becomes central to the conversation, but also this idea that if a person died in an unusual way, you know, if they were murdered or suicide or, you know, tragic illness, that sometimes their soul can get trapped in their body. And from the grave, it almost becomes demon-like and feeds on the people who are still living. And so what happened is those doctors came over with the German mercenaries. And after the war was over, they kind of stuck around and traveled the New England area, helping villages out with medical needs, which was admirable and useful, but passed along some of these, you know, like twisted bits of medical science. And, you know, that you get to the point where in 1892 or 1893, George Brown's daughter Mercy dies, and she's the third in his family to pass away. And now his son is sick, and they don't really understand what's going on. So they do this thing that George Stahl had, you know, proposed, which is called a therapeutic exhumation. You dig up the dead, you look for the one that's more preserved than the rest, and that's the one that's possibly feeding on the living, and then you cut out the heart and you burn it.
Right, and it's amazing to think that this was happening in America at the very end of the 19th century. That's a decade or two after Louis Pasteur made breakthroughs in how we understand and treat diseases.
Yeah, well, and not just happening then. I mean, you think about all that's going on in the 1890s. You've got these world fairs and exhibitions and huge advancements in science and society. But at the same time, just miles away from Exeter is Newport, Rhode Island. You know, you think of this, you know, summer community where all these massive mansions are built by the wealthy and the elite, and right in their backyard, you've got these people digging up the dead and cutting out hearts and burning them. It's quite a contrast.
It is. And even later than that, you have actual werewolf sightings late into the 20th century here. You talk about the Beast of Bray Road, which was some kind of wolf-like creature that kept popping up in Wisconsin in the late 1980s. I mean, it's hard to imagine us still believing in werewolves, but apparently these folks clearly thought they saw something.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the stories, I mean, it's the pure stories that get disbelieved the most. You talk about the pure werewolf tale of, you know, a person who turns into a wolf and only on the full moon kills people and then changes back. You know, the Stephen King sort of story. Those get disbelieved a lot sooner, but you go up into Wisconsin and you've got these tales that are sort of mingled with really ancient Native American folklore about, you know, enormous, almost human-sized wolves and dogs. And, then you get strange sightings in the woods and stories crop up. And people have had some really weird encounters with things they just can't put a name to or an answer to. And yeah, sometimes it's just easy to grab onto that werewolf thing and use it.
And speaking of these sort of cryptozoological creatures, I think one of my favorite strange legends has always been that of the Jersey Devil, by which I don't mean Snooki or Chris Christie. I'm talking about this weird creature that was described as some kind of strange sort of Frankenstein amalgam of different animal parts. I think it would take a lot of imagination to invent a monster like this, and yet hundreds of sightings were reported, right?
That's the bizarre thing about it. I mean, you think of what will people imagine if they want to make up a story and pass it around? And they tend to veer toward the simple. And instead you get this creature that, I mean, it's described as having the head of a deer and the wings of a large bird, but maybe a large bat and, you know, just a weird elongated body. It's very unique and hard to imagine that people just made this up to talk about it. But, you know, that's what folklore is like. It has a way of adapting and mutating over time.
Right. And it takes a lot of reverse engineering to get back to the root of these legends. What was the origin story of the Jersey Devil? Wasn't it something like a woman gave birth and cursed the baby or something like that?
There's a story from maybe 300 years ago. And it's one of those stories, just like a lot of folklore, where there are multiple variations of it and some of the names and places change. But essentially a woman who potentially dabbled in witchcraft, or maybe she was the lover of, like, the colonial lover of a British soldier, and so there was some traitorous things going on there. gave birth to a child, apparently her 13th child, and she cursed it before it was even born. And the story says that, you know, the child was born and then sprouted wings and flew up the chimney, and that was it. And that's supposedly the, you know, the creature that stuck around for about three centuries terrorizing people.
Boy, talk about empty nest syndrome.
I know, right?
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll have more with Lore's Aaron Mankey when we come back in just a minute. Today's episode is sponsored by Sonos. Folks, I can't tell you what a fan I am of my new Sonos speakers. Last weekend, I had some friends over, and they couldn't believe the kind of sound I was getting out of my Sonos Play 5 speaker and how intuitively it worked with all my music apps. They all wanted to play with it and see how it works, sync up their own music with my Sonos speaker, and after that night, a couple of them ordered Sonos speakers for themselves the very next day. Heck, I like it so much I even got a second Sonos speaker for my office, because Sonos is the Einstein of smart speakers. Sonos lets you have pulse-pounding sound in any room or every room all at once. That's right. Play a different song in the living room, bedroom, even bathroom, or play the same track in every room. Add your existing music services or discover something new. Whether curated or on demand, free or subscription-based, Sonos has you covered with access to a growing list of music services. Plus, Sonos' simple app lets you control everything from songs to volume to rooms all in one place. And now Sonos is offering Kick-Ass News listeners 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. That's a savings of up to $250. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Just visit Sonos.com and use the promo code NEWS10. Again, if you want to receive this special offer, go to Sonos.com and use that special promo code NEWS10, NEWS in all caps, 10. I love my new Sonos speakers, and I know you're going to love them too. And now, back to the podcast. We usually do think of modern technology and science as the eradicators of monsters and mythologies, but I guess that's not always the case. Sometimes new technology gives birth to new fears. I'm thinking particularly of gremlins. And what's weird about this is that gremlin stories paralleled the development of airplanes, and throughout World War II, gremlin sightings were reported by pilots on both the Allied and Axis sides and all over the world.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. It is this bizarre juxtaposition where people, you know, our knowledge, our experience, our bravery through advancements in technology, they've all grown. And yet at the same time, there's this deep superstition and fear that's being passed around, and, you know, crosses borders, it crosses cultures and languages. And, you know, the gremlin story is just part of a larger global story about this common little people folklore mm-hmm. that we have, whether it's the, you know, the elves of Iceland, where 53% of the people there claim they believe in elves, or the Irish stories of the Pooka, which are small, mischievous, human-like creatures that if you make them upset, they'll make your life miserable. And that description's identical to, you know, what's known as the Ibu Gogo in Indonesia, which is another island halfway around the world from Ireland. And yet they tell the same stories, and it's really bizarre that it happens that way. But yeah, these stories follow us, you know?
They do. And this gets to a recurring theme that comes up a lot, which is this notion of the other and our ideas about outsiders in our society. What are a few other examples of how that fear manifests itself in our storytelling?
You know, a lot of the tales about witchcraft are really about the other. You know, they're about mm-hmm. the person who doesn't fit in, who doesn't adhere to the rules, or they're outside of what makes us feel comfortable. You know, I think about, I think it's episode 12 called Half Hanged, which is a story about colonial Massachusetts in the early 1600s and a woman named Mary Webster who, you know, she ticks all those boxes. She's cranky. She's outspoken in a time when women are supposed to, you know, sit down and shut up. And she's not as religious as people would like. And so she doesn't really make everybody happy. And they accuse her of witchcraft for some reason. And she's taken to Boston and gone on trial. And she's acquitted and comes home victorious. And people in town are pretty upset about that. And when one of the town elders gets sick and, you know, they're afraid he's going to die, and they're trying everything they can and he won't get well, they assume it's because Mary has come back to town and she's cursed him. And so a bunch of young men just go to her house one evening in the middle of a snowstorm with a rope, and they drag her outside and they string her up in the tree. And when she stops moving, they cut her down and walk away. And, you know, this is a common thing in a lot of folklore about witchcraft, about, I mean, even the werewolf craze in Europe. And some historians think that more people were killed because they were accused of being werewolves than witches.
Really?
What I like about Merriam-Webster's story, though, is that these young men went back to the house of this town elder and he ended up dying. So whatever they tried, you know, get rid of the witch and he'll get better, it didn't work. And then the following morning, Mary gets up and walks away and somehow survived the hanging. And, you know, it's like this, it's one of those tales. A lot of them are sad. A lot of them are depressing because it's just about how hatred drives us to do horrible things. But in Mary's case, there's a little bit of victory at the end of it because she walks away from it all. And I like that. It's like a little slap in the face to society. Of course, she goes on to, you know, have a line of descendants, and one of her modern descendants is Margaret Atwood, who is the creator of, you know, The Handmaid's Tale, and, you know, this show that, you know, like her namesake, and, you know, like this ancestor, she's in the society today slapping us in the face again, and I like that.
Yeah, it does seem that so many of these tales revolve around gender roles and what happens when a woman breaks them. In fact, I think a subheading to lore could easily be poor put upon women and the stupid things guys do to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's an example of you give a bunch of white men power and bad things happen, you know?
Yeah.
But we've moved on from that. We're so much better in our society today. So
Right, of course. One story that certainly illustrates this, and I think for me it must be the most insane story of all, is the one of an Irish woman named Bridget Cleary. Tell us about her fate.
Yeah, so Bridget Cleary grew up in an era that was kind of, again, like Mercy Brown's story in the 1890s. Same era, I think it was 1897 for Bridget's story, where, you know, you're on that cusp of the old world and the new world. And, you know, one of the common beliefs of old Ireland was this idea that the elves could come and take your loved one. And when they did, they would replace the loved one with a duplicate that wasn't really your loved one, but you often couldn't tell. And they called them changelings. And these changelings would kind of exist in the old person's role, but because they behaved differently, they would stand out. And so it became this way of explaining things like why your baby was colicky and cried through the night. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, when it had had months and months of not doing that, well, the logical reason, of course, is that the elves took your baby and replaced it with a less well-behaved changeling. Or, you know, if a woman's husband is kind and loving for the first year of their marriage and then he transforms into a monster, you know, metaphorically speaking, and, you know, he's angry all the time and shouts, and, well, his personality changed because it's not really him anymore. It's a changeling. So Bridget was one of these women who got sick. She'd been out in the rain, and she was in a marriage that was a little tense at the time. She was very successful with the two businesses that she was running on her own. Her husband wasn't as successful, and it was a point of pride, you know, for the man to provide for his family, and he wasn't able to. And so when she got sick and really started to change personality-wise, he just assumed that she was a changeling, and that led him and the immediate family and friends to some pretty drastic steps.
Really? You think burning your wife alive in a fireplace is drastic?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's pretty drastic, right?
You know, just a
push
bit.
Your wife into the fire. And the belief was that if the changeling was burned, that the elves would recognize the error of their ways, right? And send the wife home and send the person home. And I think the common belief in that time was that the person would ride back from one of the local fairy rings, which was, you know, they were essentially the remnants of old Iron Age forts, but they called them fairy rings. And you know, Michael Cleary just assumed that Bridget would ride back on a horse dressed in white and grab a knife and headed out to the fairy ring to meet her and cut her binds. And she never showed up.
Right. And I think he eventually got out of prison. It's just remarkable what fear can drive us to do to others, and so often even to the people we love the most. it seems that so many of these stories end with the human reaction to the monster or the perceived threat getting so far out of hand that we become more violent and horrific than the thing we fear. Is there a running theme here that perhaps ordinary humans are the scariest monster of all?
Absolutely. I mean, part of it has to do with trust and assumption, right? We assume that monsters are bad and we won't trust them. You know, a werewolf is something that will lock the door and fight off. But I think it's a lot more frightening to realize that the person who lives in the house with you or the person who's in the apartment above you might potentially be just as violent or broken. And so, yeah, it's humans that end up being the monsters we fear the most.
Does it ever make you at all cynical about people when you read in story after story about what horrible things ordinary human beings are capable of doing to each other?
Well, I can be a little cynical about humanity as a whole. You know, I mean, we've had centuries and centuries to learn things. Back again to the idea of the other, you know, you talk about Matthew Hopkins in the 1640s English Civil War era and how he traveled around and was responsible for the trial and execution of over 150 people for witchcraft, just about as much or more as the entire century before him. And he was a busy guy, and he did it all because of hatred for what he perceived to be heresy and devil worship. And you know, it's easy to walk away from that and think 4 centuries is an awful long time, and we've certainly got better than that. And we don't, you know, we don't burn or hang people for witchcraft anymore, but we've just shifted what the other is, I think. And, you know, just have to open up CNN.com or, you know, a newspaper and see that we're still, you know, hunting people, for not being like us. And it's a shame. So, that's on the general level. On the specific level, I look at the people around me and I have a lot of faith. You know, there's a lot of good people out there, and, you know, I think, you know, the idea of resistance is prevalent in our culture in the last year or so. But I think this idea of resisting is always important, just that there's human nature and there's human tendency. And then there's trying to be better and trying to rise above that and resist. And so we keep plugging away.
Well, we want to believe as a society that we're above the kind of paranoia that breeds witch hunts and leads people to dig up and decapitate corpses. But with the modern barrage of conspiracy theories and disinformation on the internet and the Alex Joneses of the world spreading fear of new boogeymen, whether it's our own government or immigrants or vaccinations, is it easy to imagine that same kind of hysteria taking a different but equally destructive form in the 21st century?
I mean, I think it's safe to say it already has. You know, look at the people that were accused of witchcraft in the 1600s. And the common thing is that they weren't as religious as people wanted them to be. They didn't toe the line. A lot of them tended to work as midwives, work in herbs and, you know, homemade remedies and medicines. And some of that was seen as a dark art when it was just a different way of doing things. It was another approach to life. And so these women who, you know, were different, they behaved differently, were treated as if they were the enemy. And then, you know, blanket statement, if you found out that your neighbor was growing herbs to treat women who were in labor, then your first assumption was that she was a witch. And then, you know, you fast forward 4 centuries and, you know, what do people do when they find out that their neighbors are, you know, of Arab descent or that they have, you know, Muslim parents at the school? And I think a lot of people still make that blanket statement leap or assumption that, well, they've probably got a bomb vest on underneath their coat. And, you know, it's, I think it's part of our nature that we just assume that everyone who fits a label, you know, gets all of those bad qualities, but it's not true. And yet we, you know, we still go on the witch hunts, right?
Seems like it. Well, I have to ask, when it comes to these supernatural stories, superstitions, the unseen world, do you consider yourself a believer or a skeptic?
Well, so I think it's important when you tell a story to make sure that if it has sides, right, if there's a pro or a con, or if there's a belief and a disbelief, it's important to come down right in the middle so that people don't feel like you're pushing them to one side or the other. But that they get to make their own minds up. And so I try to present these stories in a way that gets the facts out, gets the stories out. I tell people what other people firmly believe they've heard. And then I let them process that on their own. You know, the questions that I want to answer are, they have more to do with humanity, right? Why mm-hmm. would we have done that thing? Or why would people have believed that particular story? And I think that's worth tackling. Mm-hmm.
In your research into dark history and these mysterious tales, have you run across a story that's been verified, lots of witnesses, but simply defies explanation and perhaps even makes you question your logical brain?
Well, yeah, I think going back to something like the Jersey Devil, I think a lot of the creature stories, you know, because we've explored so much of the world and we have gotten so good at classifying and labeling and, you know, putting everything in order, that to believe that there are these things out there, whether they're one-off remnants of some offshoot species or they're, you know, they're random sightings of just a small population of some unknown creature, it they're really difficult to believe. But mm-hmm. but the sightings happen, right? And they happen over, you know, sometimes long periods of time. The Jersey Devil was about 3 centuries worth of sightings and experiences. And it's kind of hard to say off the top, no, that can't be true. Like, you have to at least say they are telling stories. They're consistent. They don't go away. And why is that? And let's explore that. So, yeah, I think those people call them cryptids, or, you know, these unknown, undiscovered creatures. Those are the ones that really make me scratch my head a little bit.
How about in your own life? Have you ever seen something you couldn't explain?
No, I think I've lived a pretty boring life when it comes to that. And maybe that's why I'm able to go into this with a bit of an, you know, a neutral position. I don't walk into it as a believer or an unbeliever. I just walk into it as somebody who loves the story and wants to tell it. And I think that helps it mm-hmm. connect with more people in the end.
Well, let me ask you this. What's your biggest fear?
You know, mine come down to some of the basics that a lot of people fear. You know, open water for me, and I live on the coast, so it's a pretty ironic fear, but I'm a Midwestern boy by raising, and there's something about being on a boat in water that's really deep that's a little frightening to me. And then a more common fear that a lot of people share is the fear of being buried alive, and that might be tied a bit to claustrophobia and a lot of other issues, but yeah.
I also want to mention the pictures in the book. You have a background as a graphic designer, so you must have enjoyed being able to incorporate animation into the Lore TV series and these great illustrations in the book. They almost seem reminiscent of Edward Gorey. Are you a Gorey fan?
Yeah. You know, not obsessively. I don't have any collections of his work, but I don't remember what program it is, and maybe you'll remember this, but there was a BBC
PBS mystery series,
like,
right?
The mystery theater
Yeah, yeah, the opening credits.
Yeah, and I think that was Gorey, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely, like, as a memory of my childhood, that's frozen in there as what, if you're going to present spooky stories or something that's a little bit on the scary side, but also give it, you know, just enough lack of realism that you're not completely frightened. Gorey was, I think he was the master at that. The artist that I worked with for the book, his name is M.S. Corley, and he, you know, it wasn't the goal wasn't to let's go recreate what Edward Gorey did, but it was to take those same qualities, to say it needs to be creepy, but also not too creepy, you know, realistic enough, but not so realistic that it's frightening. And, you boil it down and you end up with something that's very reminiscent of that. It's in the same spirit, for sure.
Well, this book, The World of Lore, Monstrous Creatures, is the first in what will be a trilogy of lore books. Can you tell us anything about the next two?
Yeah. So the idea with this was to take episodes from Lore, the podcast, plus additional material, and sort it, kind of sift it into 3 categories. And we all know the definition of a noun. A noun is any person, place, or thing. And I thought I would just focus on nouns. So the first book is the things, right? It's the creatures, the ghosts, the vampires, the werewolves. It's the non-human entities in our world of folklore. The second book comes out at the end of May next year. It's called Wicked Mortals, and that's the people book. Mm. You know, it's stories about folks like H.H. Holmes, the notorious serial killer from Chicago. Mary Webster's story is in there. A lot of local legends about people, you know, whether they're key figures in the town or, you know, that cranky woman next door, you know, again, fitting that other archetype. So the Wicked Mortals has a lot of the people stories in there. And then the last one is Places. It's called Dreadful Places. That'll be out next October, if all the plans line up accordingly. And those are stories that are sort of geographically based, whether it's the Stanley Hotel, which has some, you know, contributions to the book The Shining by Stephen King,
mm-hmm.
Or whether it's cities themselves like Richmond, Virginia, or New York City. All of these geographic locations have a lot of great story to tell with their location as the root. So, yeah, those are the kind of the three directions. And what I like about the books is that, you know, rather than, you know, on a podcast, people sometimes, you know, they hop around, but most of the time they listen in order. And so they hear an episode on elves from Iceland early on, and then, you know, months can go by, and then you get an episode on the Dover Demon or Gremlins and all the stories of the little creatures. They're there, but they're spread out. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a lot of time to rinse your head, put new story in there, and forget the small details. And so what the book does is it takes all the things, but then it groups them together even more specifically, and it puts all of the undead stories together and all of the little creature stories together, so that when you read them and you read the Gremlins and then you read the Iceland elves all back to back, all the little details that are similar start to float to the surface in your mind. And the power of that folklore just becomes that much more evident. So it's really, mm-hmm. it's a great way to present it.
Yes, and in a similar way, the long-form Amazon series also allows you to group similar tales together around a particular theme. I thought that they were all very well done, both visually and narratively. What's the word from Amazon on a second season?
Too early to say, okay. But I will say that the reaction from fans and newcomers has been, you know, off the charts. It's amazing how people resonate with this mix of, you know, learning through some creative historical documentary, but also just watching and being thrilled by, you know, talented actors on the screen living out the scenes.
It's extremely well done. You've got a lot of talent behind and in front of the camera on that show. Well, before we go, this episode will air on October 30th. Can we look forward to a special Halloween episode of Lore?
Well, I guess I would say that at the time that this launches, I would have an episode out as well on the 30th. And it's a really spooky story. It dips into some of my darker fears and some great folklore. It's the longest episode I've ever done. Sort of you know, like a Halloween treat for everybody. It comes with a brand new soundtrack by Chad Lawson. He's got that available in streaming places, CD and vinyl, which I'm excited about. I'm a vinyl guy, so I got my hands on that early. If today, Monday the 30th, is just a fantastic day to go dig into some good stories.
All right, folks. Well, once you finish listening to Kick-Ass News, dim the lights, maybe start a fire, and go listen to the special Halloween episode of the Lore podcast. Definitely check out the 6-episode Lore television series on Amazon and Aaron Mankey's new book called The World of Lore, Monstrous Creatures. Spooky stuff. Aaron, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
And happy Halloween.
You too.
Thanks again to Aaron Mankey for coming on the podcast. Check out Lore on iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast. Don't miss the Lore Amazon series available now. And order The World of Lore, Monstrous Creatures on Amazon or download the audiobook on Audible. You can learn more about Lore and Aaron Mankey at lorepodcast.com and aaronmankey.com. That's Aaron with 2 A's, Mankey, Mahnke. And follow both on Twitter at lorepodcast and @amankey. Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. Imagine if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front. That way you could try day trading the markets without worrying about the risk. Well, luckily you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. We're also sponsored by Sonos. I was just telling you about my new Sonos speakers earlier during the break. I'm telling you, folks, these are the Einstein of smart speakers. I set up my Sonos Play 5 in the living room with zero hassle, no wiring to deal with, and within about 5 minutes, I was all set up with all my music accounts, my Spotify, my Pandora, Apple Music, and I was enjoying all my favorite tunes. My amazing Sonos Play 5 speaker fills the room with crystal clear sound like never before. Whether curated or on demand, free or subscription-based, Sonos has you covered with a growing list of music services in any room or every room all at once. And now for a limited time, Sonos is offering Kick-Ass News listeners 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. Just use the promo code NEWS10, that's NEWS in all caps, 10, at Sonos.com to receive this offer. One more time, Sonos.com and offer code NEWS10 for 10% off. Also, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. And please take a moment to take our listener survey at podsurvey.com/kick. So we can get to know who's listening, and it's also helpful with our advertisers. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.